Well, hey everybody, it is great to see you, whether you're here in the room or joining us online, and a special shout out to the 100 or so of you that are camping, pretending they're homeless for a couple nights. It's pretty awesome, right? Yeah, but it is an honor to have you along for the ride. We're in the third week of a series called The Rest of the Story, thank you, in which we are exploring some of the most iconic narratives in the Old Testament, as you may have never heard them before. And to get us going today, I want to remind you of the question that a friend asked me years ago that eventually provided the creative spark for this series. It's a good question, and it went like this. Do you ever struggle to believe that some of the Old Testament stories actually happened? In other words, when we read some of the more epic Old Testament narratives, are we reading history, or is there something else going on? And he asked me this question just after we returned from visiting a church service where we sat through a sermon that outlined the various types of fish that could have swallowed Jonah and kept him alive for 3 days. And he, being an overly analytical fella, still is, right? Very charming sometimes, but right? He got in the car and he said, "Really?" That was his comment on the sermon. "Really?" And now, as I said, this is a great question, because if we're being honest, there is some pretty incredible stuff in the Old Testament. Plus, if you grew up in church like I did, this question has a little topspin because you were probably taught to read every word of the Old Testament literally, and you were taught that anybody who didn't do that didn't really believe in the Bible or God or Jesus or really any of it, right? And if you grew up in church like I did, that perspective probably worked pretty well for you until the day your overly analytical friend asked you some version of this question, right? And I remember in response to my friend's question back in the day, I remember thinking, I'm not sure what to say. I mean, if there's a God and I fully believe and trust that there is, then it's all certainly possible, because anything is possible. But see, that day, I didn't say much because I didn't know what to say. In fact, I didn't know what to say in answer to this question until years later, when I took an introduction to the Old Testament class in seminary. And it was in that class that I was introduced to another way to read those Old Testament stories. And the professor was clear. It's not that reading them historically and literally is wrong. He said, but there is another way to approach them, and it's a way that can be incredibly helpful to people who struggle to reconcile some of what they read in the Old Testament with their experience of our world. And here's the thing that surprised me the most. This is a way of reading that has deep roots within the Jewish tradition that actually gave us the Old Testament. It's a way of reading that invites us to read the Old Testament, well, read it literarily before we try to read it literally. And consequently, it's a way that encourages us to sort of look past the unexplainable and seemingly impossible elements in a particular story in order to consider the message that God wanted to convey to his people through that story, as well as to discover why these people, the people of Israel, have chosen to tell and retell these stories to their children for literally thousands of years. I'm telling you, after leveraging this approach, I'm convinced that it's an absolutely profound way to experience these narratives. And that's why, for the first part of this summer, I want to revisit some of these stories. You may remember them from Sunday school growing up in church, and I want to explore them as you may never have before, to show you, in a very real sense, the rest of the story. And so now that said, with our time together today, I want to explore an Old Testament narrative that's often ignored due to the unusual elements within it. And it's a story from the life of Moses. But before we get to it, I kind of want to set it up by sharing an experience that I had a few summers ago while I was hanging out with a group of guys at sunset on a pontoon boat. Who's with me? Yeah. And fun fact, my brother has always said that the pontoon boat is the minivan of the inland lake, which is probably why I feel so comfortable on them, right? I mean, I have done time in a minivan. Friends, we had a whole year and a half. We were a two minivan family. That's next level, okay? I'm just telling you. But anyway, so we were on this boat, northern Michigan lake, sun was setting. We were talking about life and love and faith when one of the guys looked at us and said, "Hey, Have you ever felt like something was wrong even though nothing was wrong? And it's sort of, that's kind of how we all responded. We're like, what? I think what he was trying to get after, he's like, have you ever experienced a season of life when you've had a sense that you were missing something, but it was something you couldn't quite identify? And I asked him to elaborate, and he quickly affirmed that at least from an outsider's perspective, like nothing was wrong in his life. His marriage was strong. His kids weren't yet to the age where they could really get in trouble. I mean, they had their moments, but you know what I'm saying. And everything at work, he said, was sort of up and to the right. And his family had just returned from a trip to Europe. And he said, you know, I'm even looking for a new car, and I'm going to purchase it with cash. And at that point, we all kind of looked at him like, we don't really like you. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, Dave Ramsey's a fan, but the rest of us, can we just push you off the pontoon boat, right? But nonetheless, his point was valid. He had this nagging suspicion that he was missing something. Something was wrong, even though nothing was wrong. And then I asked him a question that took our conversation in an unexpected direction. I said, what do you want right now? In other words, what motivates you to get out of bed in the morning? Is there something, some vision or bigger purpose that compels you? And after a minute of reflection, he said, well, I haven't thought about it, but I guess I want to be comfortable. And in an instant, I knew what was wrong. And I know because I've experienced this phenomenon myself. Let me explain. Years ago, during a communications class in college, I was assigned to and read a book by a man named Robert McKee. And the book is called Story. It has a terrible looking cover for you graphically inclined people. But anyway, Robert McKee's Story is based on a famous 3-day class that he puts on for screenwriters. Like, those are the people who work in the film and television industry that create the stories that shape our culture. And in this book, Robert McKee argues that in a great script, in a great story, a character wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. Said a bit differently, a compelling story is driven by a protagonist with a clear desire, and the story advances as the protagonist navigates through conflict and tension to pursue what he desires. Conflict or tension, then, is essential to a good story, because without it, the story simply isn't very interesting. And so now, in case you were wondering, I bring this up not because I want to introduce you to the principles of screenwriting, but because I'm convinced that the things that make a great story also make for a meaningful life. In other words, in a great or meaningful life, somebody wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. In other words, the quest for whatever it is that someone wants creates the tension that gives their life meaning. And if you think about it, you already know this is true. I mean, most of us remember that season where we were falling in love, right? And if you were anything like me, it was a season in which staying up, talking with another human being until 2 a.m. was normal, okay? I haven't seen 2 a.m. in decades, all right? But during that season, man, I couldn't get enough time with my now wife, Sarah. And that season was full of risk, and it was full of promise and long walks on the beach, right? Or maybe this. Maybe you remember a season, maybe back during your college days, when you were swept into a movement that was working for some positive change in our world. You became so convinced and convicted that there was an existential threat to humanity that you spent an incredible amount of time, energy, and resources fighting against it. Those were the seasons where there was a clear objective, something worth pursuing, and we went after it with all our hearts. But see, here's what happens. If you're like most people in our culture, you graduated, or you got married, or you graduated and got married, and you got a job, and you bought a house, and then you had a couple kids, and maybe even you bought a pontoon boat, and then eventually found yourself asking a group of friends if they'd ever experienced a season in which they felt like something was wrong, even though nothing was wrong. A season in which your primary goal, if you're being honest, was to be comfortable. A season in which the only thing that you wanted really wasn't worth wanting, or at least not worth living for. You know, like new clothes or a new phone or more followers on social media or a newer car or a newer kitchen. But see, the trouble with chasing comfortable as your primary goal is that it won't ultimately lead you to a satisfying life. And that's why I'm convinced that that sense that something is wrong, even when nothing seems to be wrong, it's actually a gift. Because your Creator, your Heavenly Father, instilled within you a longing for purpose and potential to make this world a little more like He wants it to be, to help His kingdom to come and His will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. And this has been true for like as long as there have been people. And so that said, it really shouldn't surprise us that the authors of the Bible, especially those Old Testament narratives, recorded many accounts of individuals who lived compelling stories. People who chose to intentionally step away from what was comfortable and to pursue their greater purpose. And my favorite example of this is found in a famous story from the life of Moses that was recorded in the second book of the Old Testament. It's a document we call Exodus. And as that narrative begins, we meet Moses. We learn that he was a descendant of a man named Abraham, who generations earlier was the founding father of the people of Israel. And we learn that because of a highly unusual set of circumstances, Moses had been raised in royalty, in the Egyptian palace, during a time when his ancestral people had been enslaved in Egypt. The author of Exodus goes on to say that one day, when he was around 40 years old, Moses witnessed a profound injustice. The author described it this way. He wrote, "One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor." This would have been pretty common, but this was a little different day. He said he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. And now apparently in this moment, Moses was swept up into a wave of emotion. I mean, he wouldn't have time to fully consider the implications of his actions before what he chose to do next. And the author described it efficiently. He said, "Glancing this way and that and seeing no one, Moses killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand." He goes on to say, "When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well," which is an interesting detail. It becomes significant in a minute. But the scholars tell us that the overland journey from the region of Egypt where Moses would have lived to Midian would have been 250 or 300 miles, and it would have taken him several weeks to travel by foot or caravan. The point that the author seems to be making is that Moses traveled far from Egyptian territory to an incredibly remote location to hide, to withdraw from everything he had ever known. And shortly after his arrival, Moses met seven daughters of a local priest when they came to draw water from the well, right? And soon after, he married one of those daughters and settled into a new life. That's where we find Moses at the end of Exodus chapter 2. But then you move on to Exodus chapter 3, and you learn that between the last word of 2 and the first word of 3, another 40 years have passed. And during that time, Moses has been serving as a shepherd for his father-in-law. And this is a bit obvious, but the life of a shepherd is, for the most part, predictable, right? Like, pretty much all they do all day is hang out with sheep who like to take selfies, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. But not a particularly interesting or compelling story, kind of Groundhog Day. See, and as chapter 3 begins, Moses has been doing this for decades. I think it's worth noting that it would have been unusual and even shocking for Moses, a former prince of Egypt, good name for a movie, someone should make it, right? Yeah, to work as a shepherd, because in ancient Egyptian society, shepherds were generally viewed with contempt. Even the author of Genesis wrote this about shepherds. Look at this. "All shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians." And so Moses goes from royalty to a shepherd. Moreover, as someone raised in royalty, Moses would have been expected by the people to hold a position of power in midlife, not a position of manual labor. It was a stunning reversal of status. And so after killing the Egyptian, Moses must have felt that his only choice was to live out his days in rural obscurity. But I have to wonder if, as Moses looked up at the desert stars at night, he ever found himself suspecting that something was wrong, even though nothing was wrong. An ache in his soul to live a life of meaning and purpose. But he just resolved himself that this was all that there would ever be. You see, but then the story continues, the author wrote that God dramatically made contact with Moses and invited him into a better story, a better life. And the author of Exodus described it this way. He wrote, "Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. It says, then the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. And I love the author noted that Moses watched the burning bush long enough to notice that it didn't burn up. Apparently, he didn't have anything better to do than investigate random burning bushes, right? I mean, as I mentioned, he would have spent his days leading sheep in circles, so anything unique would have drawn his attention. But anyway, as Moses approached the burning shrubbery, and hold your questions for now, it began to speak to him. And the author described it this way. He wrote, "When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, 'Moses, Moses.' And Moses said, 'Here I am.'" And rest assured, this would have been as unexpected for Moses as it would be for you or me. I mean, Moses very likely would have encountered burning bushes during his time in the desert. That happens from time to time. But I can say with a high bit of certainty that this was the first burning bush to engage him in a conversation. Okay, then God continued. He said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. In other words, God said to Moses, "I'm the same God who made contact with your ancestors." And that's hugely important. I mean, Moses would have heard stories, maybe around the campfire, of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob's encounters with God. And I suspect, though, he would have seen them as stories. The children of Israel at this time had been in Egypt for 400 years. That's as far as we are from the year 1625. Think about that, right? And during that time, as far as we can tell, God had been more or less silent. Nonetheless, in this moment, Moses knew that the stories were true. And while he was scrambling to grasp the implications of that reality, God told Moses something absolutely incredible. He said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them." And I think Moses would have been thrilled. Like, God had been watching. He had been waiting. He cared about the injustice that had been inflicted on the children of Israel even more than Moses did. And now apparently the time had come for God to make his move. But see, as it turns out, the move God was about to make left Moses a little confused. Here's what God said. He said to Moses, "So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." In other words, God essentially said to Moses, "Hey, Moses, good news. I've seen. I've heard. I'm concerned. I've come down. Now, here's the plan. You go and lead the people out of slavery." And I can easily imagine Moses thinking, "Me? respectfully, God, sir, you should go talk to Pharaoh, okay? In fact, this whole burning talking bush thing, very effective. You should keep it going. I could even maybe get a shrubbery in before and you could just make that happen." But see, that wasn't God's plan. He wanted to invite Moses to want something again, to leave comfort, to leave predictability, to leave security, and to once again find purpose, like a reason to be, a bigger, better life. And yet, not surprisingly, Moses was afraid. Because leaving what's comfortable requires risk. And it invites tension into his story. But as we've said, prioritizing what's comfortable doesn't make for a meaningful life. See, but a lack of desire to seek tension, that wasn't even Moses' initial objection. His was a bit more pragmatic. He just didn't feel worthy. And as such, he objected to the idea that God could use someone like him. So he asked God, "Who am I?" Like, seriously. I was raised in royalty, and then I murdered a guy and hid him in the sand, and I've been a shepherd for 40 years. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites up out of Egypt? God, this makes no sense. You've picked the wrong guy. And in response, God answered him. He said, "But I will be with you." In other words, Moses, as you step away from what's comfortable and into adventure, the adventure that I've designed for you, you don't go alone. I'm inviting you into my story. But in spite of that promise, Moses still had concerns about God's plan. He said, But God, "Oh Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant." And I realize it's only been like 30 seconds, but I mean, I'm slow of speech and tongue. In other words, God, you need to find someone who can talk well to Pharaoh, and I don't talk well to anyone. You've chosen the wrong bro chacho, right? And in response, God got a little playful. He said to Moses, "Who gave man his mouth?" And Moses is like, "Oh no, here we go," right? "Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord?" He says, "Now, all of your excuses, notwithstanding, go. I will help you speak and will teach you what to say." And Moses went. He stepped out in faith into an adventure for which he felt wholly unqualified. And he got to see God move in power. In fact, he lived into a story that thousands of years later and halfway around the world, we're still talking about. Which, as you might imagine, brings me back to you and me and what we are supposed to take from this admittedly strange story about a talking, burning bush. And I'm convinced that our application begins when we ask ourselves a simple yet profound question. I mean, when you think about your life right now, do you feel like something is wrong, even though nothing is wrong? And do you currently have an ache in your soul over something in our world that needs to change for the better, or someone in our world who needs some help? Another way to think about this, have you recently prayed, "God, please send someone to do something about that"? And I would argue that maybe that someone is supposed to be you. Like the angel that listens to your prayers is kind of like, right? And maybe, why would I go prompt someone else when you've already been prompted? And maybe stepping in to meet that need is a way for you to find the passion and the purpose that you've been missing. And here's the thing. It doesn't have to be something massive or impressive. It just has to be something meaningful to you and to God in order to be meaningful. And I've been a pastor for a long time now, and I'm telling you, I have seen this over and over and over again. Someone senses something of an invitation to make a difference in someone else's life, and even though they don't necessarily feel qualified, they step out in faith and away from comfort and into adventure, and they jump and they risk and they stretch and they do something that they've never done before in order to help someone or something, and all of a sudden, their life is infused with a sense of purpose because they found a purpose bigger than simply continuing to exist for the endless pursuit of comfort. I mean, years ago, I even had a friend say to me, and this is our big idea for today, and I love this. This is so cool. "You weren't made to live on vacation." Isn't that great? You were made to make a difference. And the adventure of the life of faith is just to simply figure out, what adventure does God want you to live? And I love that. Anyway, before I let you go, really special treat. I want to share a short video that my friend Mark made a few years ago about all this. And the production company is actually out in California now. But as it turns out, the guy that runs it, I had his cell phone number and I don't know why. I was like, how will I get a hold of him quickly to get permission? And he gave us permission. Isn't that awesome? Yeah, the organization is called I Like Giving. And so he's like, yeah, it'd be really awful if I charged you. I was like, touche. Anyway, it was filmed in Grand Rapids. It's a story of what happened one day when my friend Mark's 5-year-old daughter decided to do what she could do to make the world a little better place. So I'm going to watch it. It's about 3.5 minutes, and I'll come back and share a quote, and then I'll close our time in prayer. So let's watch this.
So I regularly try to take my little 5-year-old daughter out on daddy-daughter dates, and we go do all kinds of stuff. There was this one particular Saturday where she said, Dad, I think today for our date, I would like to go collect bug shells. She shows me this little cicada bug shell that's sure enough sitting on the side of the tree, and she says to me, Dad, my friend Adele and I would like to start a business collecting bug shells. I smiled and I said, okay, what are you gonna do with the money that you make? And she said, well, we're gonna buy people water with the money. There are kids in Africa who don't have clean drinking water, and we want to help get them water. I felt about that small, thinking she was just buying water for our neighbors. And so she goes and she tells my wife the same idea. My wife finally adjusts her business model and says, well, maybe instead of bug shells, you'd be able to ask people for pop cans and money. And so they start going door to door. She and her friend, they divide up the sales pitch. One of them says, we're collecting money and pop cans. And the other one says, for kids in Africa to have clean drinking water. And so they go house to house. They interact with all of these different neighbors. And eventually they raise $67.60. And I walk into our kitchen and they're sitting there lining up all the nickels and quarters and all the different pop cans, and they say, let's send it to World Vision's water team and we'll write them a letter. And so they write this letter to World Vision's water team, and they put the $67.60 into an envelope and send it off. We got a letter back from World Vision, and you know, it's this organization that receives donations from all over the place. And in the letter, you could just tell how inspired they were by just this 5- and 7-year-old girl, you know, just doing the kid thing, living it day in and day out. And this particular day, this is just what they decided to do: was let's go help somebody have some clean drinking water. The day after they did all of this, my daughter walked up to me and she said, Dad, do you think I helped save somebody's life yesterday? And it was so cool to be able to say to her, yeah, I think you probably did.
Now that is a great story. Yeah? Yeah. I wonder what's yours. what might God do with you if you opened yourself up to the leading of his Spirit in this way? And what might your invitation sound like? And what new direction might he send your story? Because in a sense, every life is a story, and whether or not it's a story worth telling is really up to each one of us. I want to close with a quote from Robert McKee from his book, Story. This was his encouragement at the end. He said, write every day, line by line, page by page, hour by hour, for above all else, beyond imagination and skill, what the world asks of you is courage. Courage to risk rejection and ridicule and failure. He says, as you follow the quest for stories told with meaning and beauty, study thoughtfully but write boldly. And then he says this, then like the hero of the fable, your dance will dazzle the world. And that, my friends, is the rest of the story. And we'll continue our conversation next week. But for now, I'd love to invite you to stand. And I'll close our time together. And once again this week, this is a tradition if you're new around here, but we have some friends who will be under the screen to the left. If you came into this place and you'd just like to pray with someone, we would love to spend a little time with you. But for the rest of us, let me close our time. Heavenly Father, thank you for being the author of the greatest story ever told, and thank you for inviting each of us into your story. Thank you for the reminder that we were not designed to live on vacation. We were designed to pursue purpose. And this week I pray that we would all sense maybe a new invitation from you, something small but meaningful that we could do to help your kingdom to come and your will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thank you for sending Jesus to make a way, to show us the way, to be the way. And thank you for the honor that it is through him to be one of your children. And so I ask for your grace and your peace to rest on us all as we follow the way of your Son. It is in his name, the name of Jesus, that we pray. And everyone said, amen. It's been great to be with you, friends. Enjoy the weather. We'll see you next week.